Hi everyone. Welcome to tonight's event. It's really great to see such a great turnout this evening. There are a couple more chairs available in the room. Please do make sure every chair is full. My name is Luke Cooper. I work here at the LSE with the Conflict and Civicness Research Group. Welcome also to the many people that are joining tonight's discussion online via Zoom. We really have had a remarkable response to this event, and I think it's going to be a fabulous presentation and discussion. I think before I introduce Danny, I want to say a few words of housekeeping and also to introduce some of the partners that we're working with on tonight's event. So we in the LSE Conflict and Civicness Research Group and LSE Ideas are really committed to hosting passionate, provocative, argumentative ideas and criticism. If you don't know, this is quite a fitting location to discuss the many criticisms of Brexit. This building that we're in at LSE is part of LSE's commitment to hosting a whole range of different viewpoints is actually named after a very, very prominent supporter of Brexit. So really, whether you're pro-Brexit, whether you're anti-Brexit, this is a really fitting location to have this dialogue and to have this debate. You can Google it if you're interested. His name is Paul Marshall. He was one time a member of the Liberal Democrats. He's been on a journey with Brexit, and he was a big prominent supporter of the Conservative Party at the last election. So if any Remainers in the audience would like to make enormous donations to our research unit tonight, we are open to receive that, and we might be able to find a lecture theatre, or if it's big enough, even a building to name after you. This is a really great piece of work. It's argumentative, it's provocative. When I contacted Danny with my Another Europe is Possible hat on earlier in the year, asking him if he wanted to look at some of the data, take a long, hard look at some of the data and ask the question, well, what's Brexit done to Britain after this experience of leaving the European Union and what do we make of it? I was really delighted that he said yes, and the result is Brexit, a failed project in a failing state. And I think it's a really original piece of work that looks at Brexit not just from the perspective of what's happened in the last few years, but takes a much longer view, really puts it in context of 40 years of policy failure that led up to the Brexit referendum. So, as I think I might have already mentioned, I was also a co-founder of Another Europe is Possible, and this report is promoted by Another Europe is Possible as part of its partnership with Friedrich Herbert Stiften. I'm afraid if there isn't a seat for you in the room, there is an overspill location, and unfortunately due to fire safety we will not be able to have people sitting on the floor, so I'm very, very sorry about that, but we do have an overspill location, and if people leave we can get people in that location back into the room as well. So before we get going, this is a longer introduction than I intended, but we are still waiting for Zoe Williams to get to the building, so there is a logic to it. If I could ask James to say a few words about the partnership, about Friedrich Herbert Stiften, and the project with Another Europe is Possible.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks. Oh, I think my mic's a bit louder than his one, so I'll keep it at a distance. Yeah, my name's James Hocht. I'm project manager at the Friedrich Herbert Stiftung. It's a bit of a mouthful, so we just call it the FES. It's a political foundation funded by the German state, which is based in Berlin, but we work in the London office, and we've had cooperation with Another Europe is Possible for quite a few years now. Obviously, we have a particular interest in Brexit and how that's sort of damaged EU-UK relations. We work to make sure that the SPD, who we're sort of aligned with in Germany, and Labour are talking to each other, as well as other progressive forces, and trade unions as well. So we work with British and German trade unions to make sure that there's dialogue happening between them. So obviously Brexit is pretty much one of the central concerns for those discussions. The Brexit Spotlight project has been going on for a couple of years now, and the idea of it is to look at different sort of policy areas of how Brexit is having an impact, which, as Danny explains in the report, which I hope you'll read because it's great, is sometimes a little bit difficult to ascertain how to look at it, how to determine what's gone wrong and how. So we had a paper last year on environmental regulation and how Brexit is affecting that, and now this one on some more specific kind of social issues in the context of kind of wider austerity process. So yeah, that's enough from me, I think. Thank you so much for coming tonight. It's great to see such a great turnout, and yeah, I hope you enjoy the event and the discussion. Cheers.
Great, and Danny, of course, needs no introduction. He's a fantastic academic and personality, a true public intellectual, and we're really delighted to be hosting him at the LSE. Danny has read numerous books, so I won't, in filling the time for Zoe to get here, mention them all. But I will mention his most recent one, Shattered Nation, which I think is published in kind of combination with this, and in many ways the argument from it is reflected in this piece of work on Brexit as well. So do take a copy of the report away with you tonight, and do also though go and buy Shattered Nation. It's available from all good bookshops. So with that, without further ado, please give a warm welcome to Danny Dorling.
Thank you ever so much, Luke. Thank you for coming. Thank you for those who are online. It's quite nice to see some great British beards online. You don't often see the members of the online audience, but they're very, very elegant. I'm going to try to make this not depressing. I honestly tried to find positive things from Brexit. So I'll give you some, and I'll give you a few later, but the overall message, as you can probably guess, is not positive. The positive things: it was a democratic process. The European Union was a democratic process. It wasn't a super state taking over countries and forcing them to be part of it, which meant that eventually someone was going to leave. Right, you can tell it's a democratic process because you can leave. If nobody leaves, it's not a democratic process, it's an empire. And that somebody might not have been us. That somebody could easily have been a very small country, say Greece, with a land border with Bulgaria, which it thought never mattered. And it might have imagined that had it left, things would have got much, much better in Greece. Now, because of what we've done, we've saved places like Greece from thinking that. They know that if you have a small land border, it's really important and will create lots and lots of problems. They know when they look at what has happened to us, that the supposed benefits of being out aren't necessarily realised. It was going to be a one of the EU28 which went, and if you're kind of thinking about fairness, historical fairness, who's had most in the world, who's invaded more countries than anybody else, well, you know, why not us? That's my first of the positive things. Secondly, and I'll get on to what you can say about what would have happened otherwise or not, I am fairly convinced that if we hadn't voted to leave, 52-48 amongst those who voted, and that really matters because lots of people didn't, if we hadn't voted to leave, we would have had a long and protracted civil war, accusations of collusion, cronyship, traitors. If you can remember Michael and Boris's faces on the day after and their look of utter shock and horror. Yeah, we don't remember, but you should remember their look of utter shock and horror about what have we done. The plan was not to win first time. If you look at what the various Leave campaigns did, and let me put it carefully, but the legality of some of the things that they did, they never expected for it to be investigated because they didn't expect to win. Why would you expect to win? You had all the political parties against you. You had the church against you. You had the universities against you. You had Marks and Spencers against you and Lord Seif. The whole of the CBI, the trade union movement, everybody said Remain. Right? They thought they could get into the 40s and then push for a second referendum and win our sovereignty back and so on. But they weren't prepared, I don't think, to win first time. That was a shock. And what I'm trying to tell you is it was a bonus to us. I think it would have been worse if Remain had actually won by 52 Remain, 48 Leave. I think we'd have just gone through 10 years of agony. And unless another country had left and we'd learned from it, and we're not very good at learning from other countries. We don't tend to look at what they do and what happens to them. It wouldn't be bad. And cynical things, I had to show this because Luke very kindly gave me a carrier bag because I need to take some stuff home. We wouldn't have wonderful carrier bags so adorned with British flags about great British produce. Now, if you can have a look at the produce list and you can kind of guess, is it really, does that really grow in Britain? But I should say, but thank you to the Germans, who are also partly sponsoring this. This is an Aldi carrier bag about great British produce. I'll leave it there. I was going to bring my kettle for work. My kettle from work has a little certificate on the plug which says it complies completely with university regulations at Oxford, but it's held together with gaffer tape because they don't check that bit. But I've been waiting to be free of Europe so that we can get our old kettles back, you know, the ones that heat up really quickly and use far too much power. But nobody's made them because we're not a big enough market. I've been waiting to get those old light bulbs back, you know, instead of these horrible LED things, so that we can go back in time to 79. And that hasn't come. So you're going to get cynicism. I really tried in the report, I want you to read the report, because I just quote verbatim very, very large chunks of the Telegraph. Like, to be fair. And the Daily Mail. I just quote their claims about the successes. I try to look at numbers. Okay, the story. And the story will only take 20 minutes unless Zoe is later, in which case it will take 30 minutes. But one nice thing. If I was doing it, in 50 years' time from now, I'll be doing a talk, and Zoe Williams again will be arriving late. Anyway. John Major. A year after this picture was taken, 50 years on from now, Britain will still be the country of long shadows. We have special shadows. You may not know this. The shadows in other countries, well done. The shadows in other countries are different. County grounds. He didn't say cricket because you're supposed to know what a county ground is. The whole point of county cricket, and the only complaints I've had about the report so far have been that I don't understand how important county cricket is. But the whole point of county cricket, I think, is it doesn't really matter who wins. It's not about watching that much. It's about relaxing. It's about good enough is good enough. It's about not exceeding expectations, not being excellent, not being audited. County grounds, warm beer. Wonderful stuff. Except most people don't really want to drink it, but it's our beer. Invincible green suburbs. Dog lovers. As if we're the only people who had dogs. And as George Orwell said, old maids bicycling to Holy Communion through the morning mist. I hope to see an old maid bicycling before I die. He was trying to reassure people as we entered the European Union that don't worry, it'll all be the same, nothing much will change. We never entered the community for the right reason. Liz Truss wrote a beautiful chapter in Britain Unchained in which she revealed what she reads, which was about four sources. But one of them was the secret memo from the ambassador, I think he was both to Paris and Bonn or something, about how we stood in Europe. And it was a secret memo, because it revealed, of course, we didn't actually join because we wanted to be part of this, it was just to exploit it. But they think really lowly of us, and their income is going higher. This was written in 1979, and the worst thing he said is they keep on praising us for our sense of humour. And the kind of sad thing nowadays is Britain was very good at humour in the 1960s, satire, Monty Python, carried on, the young ones weren't bad. At the moment, if you want to know about low points, and I can tell you terrible low points in Britain, but actually we're no longer praised for the amazing sense of humour on our TV screens anymore. This appears to have frozen, so it's going to be, you're going to have to stare at Mr. Major for a long time.
Oh dear.
We can't go forward. These pictures are in the report. I'm not showing you the sources. Oh, there we go. Thank you. That's it. So all the sources are in the report. It's a report for the pictures. We still think we're special. And it's nice to think you're special. When I was growing up, my mother told me I was brilliant at everything, which is what your mother should do. I was brilliant at sculpting out of clay, I thought. I was brilliant at playing the recorder. I only learnt I wasn't brilliant at playing the recorder when the combined recorder groups of Oxford got together in the town hall, and in the last rehearsal, the conductor pointed at me and said, "Whatever you do for the next 2 hours, do not blow." That thing. But it's nice to think you're special. Here's special British birds. These are birds only found in Britain. Okay, we are a slightly odd country because we were the centre of the largest empire the world has ever known, which may explain why we went early. We're also odd in other ways. I'm trying to answer a question about why us before I get on to the successes and failures. This is our tax rate. Along the bottom you've got how much people earn. One means you're earning the average amount. It's a bit of an unfair graph because half the population are between 0 and 1. One is average, two is twice average income, three is three times, four times. And this is the tax rate. And we're the red line. We're a low tax, low spend economy. We're the nearest you get to a night watchman state in many ways. And you can go to local authorities now in Birmingham. You know, they have to sell everything off by Christmas. Slough, another 24, at least 20 to go by Christmas. We're not normal. Those other countries are taxing more, spending more, not relying on you looking after yourselves. They have such a thing as society. We've been trying to eat away at it. These two, Tony and Margaret, Somerville and St John's, as you think about them if you're at the University of Oxford. Everybody apart from Nick Clegg went to the University of Oxford. Almost a decade after John Major, actually John didn't go, bless him, and inequality did fall under John Major, so be nice. At a private dinner in Hampshire in 2002, and Margaret Thatcher was asked what her greatest achievement was, she replied, "Tony Blair and New Labour, we forced our opponents to change their minds." And she did. After that triumphant stance of John Major as he's won the 1992 election unexpectedly, Labour looked at itself and decided it had to do something new, something different, and it shifted to the right. There were kind of echoes today. I think Labour dropped the right to roam policy today in England. That's gone. As it dropped the commitment to allowing a third child to eat a couple of weeks ago. Labour moves to the right. That pushes the Conservatives to the right. I think it was 2009 was the last time that our Conservative Party was a proper member of the European Conservative Party, it's the European People's Party. By 2014, it was allied with a group which included, back to Germany again, Alternative for Deutschland. Right? We have not had a Conservative Party in this country since 2014, by the normal definition of what a Conservative Party is. If you're thinking about why did Brexit happen, it's because we went this way. And you can't just blame the Conservatives, because they were pushed that way by Tony Blair and his friends, who thought it was a jolly good idea to do that. But you have to explain, what was it that made Tony Blair? And you can go right back to Fetters and his school, and then what was it that made Fetters? Why do we have a military school in Scotland, private and boarding, to teach men that war is a good thing? And we should have really seen that coming. This is the inequality graphs, the Gini coefficient, after housing costs, before housing costs. The only one that matters is after housing costs, because you all really want to be housed, don't you? You don't want to sleep rough on the street, so it's just a red line. We were one of the most equal countries of Europe when I was a child. The only other large country which is fractionally more equal than us was Sweden. Right? I grew up in a Nordic country called England, in lots and lots of ways. We pull the poor apart, destroy social support, have 3 million people, mainly young, are out of work, allow the rich to accumulate more and more, drop top tax rates right down to 40%. And then we have an incoming Labour government in 1997 that at least is honest for 2 years and says it will stick to Conservative spending plans for 2 years, but then sticks to them for all the remainder of the years it's in. Those lines are flat. Here, you're only seeing one, but it doesn't matter. There are four lines. Oh, you've got the report. Those people online, you have to go to the website to find it. You've got the reports. You can look at the graph of the other three lines. 416 YouGov polls conducted in this period, 2011 to 2022, 10 years. Only four issues consistently ranked as being the most important as far as the electorate were concerned. Health, but that was in the pandemic, as you see, if I can remember my graphs correctly. Immigration and asylum, and you see how we really, really push it up to an absolute height in 2015, early 2016. What was that? What was going on in 2015, 2016 that meant that immigration and asylum suddenly mattered more than it had mattered at least since 1905? Was it that there were lots of new immigrants or people claiming asylum? No. Actually, it's gone down a bit because we'd opened up to the AA countries earlier and there wasn't a particularly spectacular bad war, although there were several, but at that time. It was the Daily Mail banging on its front page again and again, and not just the Mail, you know, give the Times credit and the Telegraph and the Express and the People. About the immigrants are coming, and they're going to take your school places, and they're going to be in the bed you not to be in hospital. They'll take your job. We have it again now. I have a friend, an elderly friend, who when I see him, asks me, Danny, what are we going to do about the small boats? And he's really worried about the small boats. He lives about as far inland in England as you can, and quite high up. But they've managed to scare him about the small boats. And you can, you know, our laugh and your laugh, but it's scary, isn't it? How on earth did we manage to do that, to get people petrified? I mean, I can see how you might be able to get people petrified about a slightly larger boat, right? But a really small boat with these people in it. Anyway, immigration and asylum really was a major factor in Brexit. Anybody who tells you no, it's about taking back control of sovereignty, no, it wasn't. A little bit of it was. I don't think all the Conservative MPs who supported it were petrified about the small boats. They just wanted something else. The economy, which you can't see there, only trumps immigration and asylum after the biggest crash we've had since 1929, and then only briefly because, hey, immigration and asylum is more important than the economy. It's not the economy, stupid, in this country. And then Britain leaving the EU, of course, becomes an issue when Britain leaving the EU really does become an issue, and people do what they were not supposed to do, what we thought that they weren't going to do, what the spread betting said wasn't going to happen, what you were absolutely sure wouldn't occur because an MP was murdered by somebody shouting fascist slogans a few days before a poll. So you go, well, that's it, we've won then, Remain's going to win. And then it's a shock, and then you think, oh, don't worry. We're an EU country, we'll do what all EU countries do. We'll just won't accept the referendum, or we'll make them do another one. No, we're different. We got the special British ducks, remember. And we get all these things saying that we need to leave because they're measuring the curves of the bananas that we grow in this country, full of bananas. Or we can't control our own policies, we can't do this, we can't do that. I won't read out the slide there, just in case you wondered what it was possible to do in an EU country, and you thought, wouldn't it be nice if you could control the price of food so people can eat? Well, there's the price controls on beaches in Greece. Right? When they told you that there's loads of things you cannot do if you're a member of the EU, they lied. They lied. A tiny number of them were so immensely stupid they didn't know they were lying, so that's not a lie. That's just stupid. But most of them are not that stupid. They lied. They knew they were lying. There's only really those two options. I'll leave you. I like the picture of the Azure Sea and so on. Terrible place, Europe. The horrible warm beaches. You don't want to be part of that. Mountains, snow. They've got this weird different history to us. Let's try and rein in the cynicism. I can get to cynicism. In case you don't believe me about we're different, we were different. This is public spending as a proportion of GDP. The numbers come from the International Monetary Fund. It starts in 1980. We're the red line. There were two countries that spent less on public services than we did back in 1980. It's almost identical to the tax take. If you add on borrowing, you get the tax take. The two countries that spent less than us in the 1980s were Greece, shortly after the generals were in charge, when it wasn't a democracy, and Spain, shortly after Franco was in charge, when it wasn't a democracy. But we are a democracy. We're the mother of democracies. We've always been a democracy. We have our democratic bishops and our members of the House of Lords and our incredibly democratic voting system that really values your votes and our wonderfully democratic sovereign and all the rest that is amazingly democratic about us. And these mainlanders really don't get it. And why am I using the word mainland? Am I talking down Britain? Am I not patriotic enough? Am I a traitor? Because I talk about the mainland as a continent as the mainland. Don't I understand that my geography? Don't I realise that we're actually halfway across the Atlantic and essentially really we are part of America that really was always ours and never left? And but there we are. And at the top you've got France and Belgium and Finland and Norway and the black line in the middle. If you want something to aspire to, as it's come up four times today, that's Germany. Right? You might want a goal that says, can't we be like Finland? I'm afraid that's off the cards for the moment. You can't have no homelessness. You can't have the best schools in the world. You can't have the best housing system. You can't have the happiest people on the planet. You can't have a summer cottage that you go to. You can't have all those lakes and mountains. I'm afraid you can't do that, and you're not going to get the saunas either. You can't be Finland, but you could try to be Germany. And why do I say you could try to be Germany? Because that black line isn't too far away from the red line. Except that's an extra billion spent on health every week. Not 350 million, that's a billion. And that's just the health spending. And it's a school system where the government pays for the schools. For almost everybody. So you go to school with other children you live near, who you think of as like you. I could tell you this sort of fairy story of a utopian land where this kind of thing might be possible. What kind of an idiot would suggest increasing our spending to German levels? That idiot in 2017, rabid extremist idiot, who wanted to do what Angela Merkel does, not quite as well, was Jeremy Corbyn. The 2017 manifesto of the Labour Party was to increase public spending after 5 years to just below the German level. He was possibly talked down to not going anywhere near where Germany is over immigration, over how many people Germany lets in, how it treats them, what it behaves. I'm not saying Germany is perfect. Like I've told you, I actually prefer Finland. But It kind of, if you're at the bottom of a class of 30, you don't say, I want to be at that desk at the front, sitting under the teacher smiling. Right? You kind of just get yourself in the back of the halfway through. That's where we are at. The problem of too many planets. This is in the middle of the report, because this is all about the what-ifs. What is possible, what is knowable? And there have been valiant efforts to estimate what would have happened economically had we not left, and how important the EU is to us, and what percentage of our GDP growth is due to it, and so on. And the problem with these efforts is that we only have 28 countries in the EU. We have hundreds of variables. You can't actually produce a model that explains or understands everything. If we had, and somebody should estimate it rather than me making it up, I'll make up, if we had 1,000 planet Earths, each with an EU, each with 28 countries, and on each of them we could run a scenario where you take different countries and take them out or don't take them out and see what works, then it would be possible to say what would have happened. But we cannot actually answer that question. I put it better in the report than this, because it's slightly complicated, but you cannot actually know. We only have one history. This is it. You cannot work out what the counterfactuals would have done. And in fact, even this history, we can't know until we get a bit further forward into the future and look back. And that's it. If you're wondering what the weird image is, my first geography lecturer, Peter Taylor, 1986, Newcastle, taught me world system theory about how the world operates, and I believed it ever since. Get them at 18, and you've got them for life. And he created the largest data set of cities in the world, how they were connected, ran a computer model to work out which were the most connected and central cities to the world economy about 20 years ago. And there you have New York and London as the twin stars around which the rest of the global economy rotates, reprojecting them into a space of economics rather than the space they normally are. That's a plane every 2 minutes coming out of Heathrow. That's the bankers moving across, all owning each other's banks. And again, it's a reason about why we left. We were that closely connected to New York. It seemed a possibility. And not just our bankers. Gordon Brown went there every summer on holiday to learn from the Americans about how to do social policy. Gordon Brown, not Tony Blair. Right, Gordon Brown. I'm just putting this map in because I like maps and I'm a geographer. 17th century Europe. I'm not quite sure about claiming that England was as united, but anyway. If you're trying to work out the future trajectories of all those little princedoms and so on, you could do a model, you could put in whether they're Catholic or Protestant, something about the agriculture, the money and so on, but actually what really matters is where they were. It's where they physically are in relation to each other. That affects whether somebody sweeps an army across you because they're trying to get somewhere else, or whether, as in the case of Amsterdam, you're in a very, very good place to move grain around the continent that's growing. So again, this is the academic bit. It's not all grandstanding in the report about trying to explain what you cannot predict and what you cannot ever know. So, if somebody who leaves says to you, but it could have been worse, well, they're right, it could have been. But we cannot actually nail it completely down because we only have one history. The point at which we will really know about what's happened will be in the future when we look back. Take things like the Suez Crisis. Right, at the time of the Suez Crisis, sorry for the young people in the room, this was when the Americans told us, no, you can't do that. And we were a bit shocked that they did. And we couldn't be in charge east of Suez anymore. And it was a bit humiliating. But at the time, we didn't say that about ourselves. At the time, we kind of gruffly went, not quite sure what's going on here, but don't worry, we're still great, and we've still got some colonies, and, you know, there's Rhodesia. Now we know what the Suez Crisis is and what it means. It's, it takes time. You have to go, you have to give it enough time. It's still too early, too painful. Well, I will get, because this is going live, 15 emails tomorrow morning. Yeah. From people I've made really upset at the moment, who probably get even more upset because I've just said, I know you're upset. And if you send me an email, because this will save me time, if you send me an email, please put your address in it and the postcode, and I will send you a book or something, because that's what I do. And I do it partly to collect the data, because none of you live near anywhere where the small boats ever get near to. It's always white villages. Too few parties. These are two graphs from the Financial Times. There are more in the reports. We do a lot of saying that our political parties are very different to each other. But political parties don't, when you step back, and certainly when you look across the whole of Europe, don't tend to actually be that different to each other. Inside a country, it feels really different. And if I go into any country, so I won't do it now and embarrass myself, but if I go into a country and say, you know, all your politicians are all pretty nice, you all believe in a welfare state, you disagree slightly about the size of it, but it's enormous what you've got. You know, and you might disagree slightly about the schools, but none of you would think of, let's build a new Eton. You just laugh. But inside a country, you think it's a wide difference. The FT produced the wonderful John Murdoch. I like every other one of John's graphs apart from this one. These graphs to try and show that Labour and the Conservatives were that different. And yes, avoidable deaths did get to the highest under the Tories, but they were pretty bad under Labour. And this is the country that in the 1950s had the best health outcomes in the world, almost the best in the 60s, not that bad in the 70s. Right, the political party didn't matter. Life expectancy at birth, we were under average under Labour, we've dropped further under the Conservatives. It's not that different. Normal European country, 8 political parties, PR, you can actually vote for who you believe in, which, again, I'll have to explain this slowly, what it might feel like. You know, you'd actually, it wouldn't be I'm doing it this way or I've got to, or here's the clothes peg that I'm going to put on my nose, which I think should be on Polly Tolbin's tombstone. It would be, and don't vote if you don't want to, or start your own. It doesn't have to be 8 parties. Here's what looks like a difference. So there's change in funding between private and state schools, and you can see that the switch happening at 210. But one way to look at that graph is to ask, why, under those new Labour years, do those two lines track each other perfectly? Were they perfectly ensuring that there was no change in the relationship between private and state schools? Labour increased the funding for state schools as a percentage in proportion to the percentage the private schools went up. So if you were to increase fees in Eton from £40,000 to £50,000, so 25% increase, yeah, 25%, then you'd increase the fees in the state school from 4,000 to 5,000. The state school child will get an extra £1,000 spent on them, the Eton child will get an extra £10,000. That's your two lines going up together. That isn't maintaining, that's actually increasing inequality. What came after, of course, is kind of like slash and burn. You know, because what's the point of sending your child to a fee-paying school if the other schools are at least slightly decent? You nearly need to cut them. And I won't go on about schools anymore, but yeah, we had a set of schools that are really good if you need to run a very large empire, and you need to make people brutal, and you need to not to think of themselves like other people, and you need to tell them that they're special, which also turns out to be quite a good set of schools to run if you want people to believe that we need to take back control, that we can run our affairs ourselves, that the reason we're not number one is because of Europe. And I am thinking of Dominic Cummings. And not just his school, but I would blame Exeter College, Oxford. I'll stop at that point. We shouldn't just blame the schools. I can find a reason for all the colleges of my university, by the way. Equal opportunity. What goes wrong? Resolution Foundation are into producing lots of very complicated graphs. They divide the population into 20 groups now and have the most carefully constructed rainbow scale. And you really don't need it now, because this is what's been happening now. Everybody but the best of 5% are seeing dramatic falls in their standards of living. The top 5% is only going up because interest rates have gone up and they've got wealth and they get the money from the interest, but even then, it's not great. And it can be argued that this falling apart was accelerated by Brexit. Our goods cost more because we have controls on them, but the trust of international bankers in us is reduced because we've left something that was more stable. Then, Liz Truss, Merton Oxford, Quasar actually might be Cambridge, but anyway, Liz Truss Merton manages to exceed even Brexit by taking on the international bankers and losing. And this is the problem of too many planets, because you've got to play your Brexit with and without Liz Truss. You know, supposing we'd kept Boris, would it have been a bit better? What do we have? We have the lowest benefits in Europe, unemployment benefits. You can't live off them, so we can celebrate, as the Resolution Foundation did today on Twitter. Isn't it amazing how few people are unemployed in London? Oh yeah, because you couldn't live if you're unemployed. You don't celebrate people taking any work they can. This is a lovely artist called Sarah Holyfield. She screen printed the universal credit regulations into a giant tapestry to show how long they are if you want to understand what it is you have to fill in. What are we good at? Three things. ONS produces statistics on chain-linked, very complicated statistics to work out which of our industries are growing. So there are three which have grown post-Brexit as far as the ONS are concerned. This one is actually from Bloomberg, not ONS. But we are world number one for online gambling. That's not per capita, we're actually bigger in total than the USA. And Malta's trying to shove through something to allow it to have a server farm, but the EU will stop it. The EU tries to control gambling, because it doesn't understand that free markets really matter. We did. Was it Lord Palmerston who explained in the House of Commons that we were going to send the gunboats in, because the Chinese didn't understand that the free movement of opium was so important? Anyway, we've gone right up. We're number one for online gambling. And this isn't Gibraltar anymore. In a way, you can be scared if you're Gibraltar, if you're Jersey, if you're Guernsey, if you're Isle of Man, because your special status is going away. We're in the LSE. You're in the heart of the new Treasure Island. Or you can call it the Edinburgh Accords, if you like, and make it sound more responsible. Banking is the one I won't show you. But our banks have done better. We've got to zoom up. Higher education. Highest fees in the world. Upper middle class people in England don't believe this. You might consider sending their children to America. Because they go, oh, it's $30,000 or $40,000 a year in the US. They go, no, not community colleges. Not that you'd ever think of sending your child there, but that is higher education. Anyway, we have the most expensive university education in the world. And although our numbers of students from the European mainland has halved, because they now have to spend overseas fees, those that are coming, our cash take has gone up. Right? We're doing better. Some of us more than others. Some universities are now getting more, and others are getting less. Because when you pay, you choose where you want to go. We're moving still to the right. This is another Labour relinquishing a commitment. The fees are here. I think the next thing to look out for is when it is announced quietly that £9,250 for home students is just too low. We really need a free market in home undergraduates coming. So things can get worse. How is this connected to Brexit? Do you think the European Union would have left alone the system where we had a rotten system of university financing and most of Europe has the most amazing? Well, it's not amazing, it's just what we had, what I had when I was young. Wrapping up, David Cameron introduced the Happiness Index around about the time he was hugging the husky. He charged ONS with measuring it. I think it's monthly, they measure anxiety amongst a representative sample of people. Goes down after the financial crash. Actually stayed quite low. If you were here in those years, 2016, 17, 18, 19, of Brexit, you might have thought you were quite anxious, but actually, 52% of you weren't, because you got what you voted for. Right? 48% of you thought it was going to be reversed, so you were quite happy, and you know, 500,000 of you joined the largest political party in Europe, and another 5 million of you thought that was a very good thing. Something terrible happened in the summer of 2019. Something really scary. And it got worse in September and October and November. And the recorded anxiety of the people of Britain soared and soared and soared to a height we had never seen before until December of 2019, when there was a landslide election and people were petrified about it and the result of it. That's the measured anxiety rate. Then there was a little event that occurred in February and March 2020 that was a bit worrying. You might die. But it only pushed the anxiety rate up a fraction above Johnson's landslide election victory. I mean, it's stunning. The other measures, are things worthwhile in life? These are, if you recognise these, if your doctor ever begins to ask you these questions, you should know what they're doing. But anyway, hopefully it don't. How satisfied are you with life? What is your level of happiness on a scale from 1 to 10? All things considered. Which is why the Finns are so happy, by the way, because they do consider everything else. And they go, yes, I'm happy. You can see them all dip, particularly happiness, with that election result and then Brexit. And how little effect the pandemic had in relation to that. It really was a traumatic effect. The pandemic was very bad, the most traumatic thing since the Second World War, but Brexit was too. This is that terrible organisation, the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds, getting angry, then being told off. You don't do that kind of thing. If you want to know about the geography of this, this is just part of the UK. The purple is UKIP. These are the kind of areas you need to look at and into and wonder, why did it stretch from the West Midlands all the way into the borders of Wales? Why did Wales vote 52-48 to leave? Who was it in Wales who was voting to leave? Where might they have grown up? Might it have been the West Midlands? Anyway, I think it's very unfair that Wales is labelled as a leave country. Yes, 52% of people in Wales voted to leave, but enough of them were retired and old and not from Wales, and enough of the young Welsh had to leave Wales to get work and were not in Wales, that I think if you were to do it another way, you would find that Wales wasn't that different from Scotland or that different from Northern Ireland. The last three slides, you'll be glad to know, are just text, which I'm not going to go through, but just to be honest with you, and say a lot of the report is not pictures, it's text. The last three are about what may be the most significant thing of all in the long term. Not the increase in food prices, not the fact that the majority of our children with a brother and sister are now going seriously hungry two or three times a month because our food's gone up more than others. Not that we have a million children destitute, as the Guardian headline went yesterday from the Joseph Ramsay Foundation research. Not that we have children freezing and old people freezing. Not that we are in the longest cost of living crisis since the Napoleonic Wars, which we are. But that this increases the chances of a breakup of a union. Now, I'm not somebody who is particularly concerned about whether we have a union or not, but it does matter for the future. Ireland is obvious. They were bunged a hell of a lot of money after Liz Truss lost her majority in 2017 due to the fastest ever recorded increase in voting for the Labour Party per year, which is what happened in 2017. Scotland is now finding it cannot do things it could do before Brexit, because the real taking back of control is actually taking it back inside the UK. There's a quote there, you can read about that. Scotland has a child poverty payment, it's allowed to make at the moment, Scottish child payment. Any family in Scotland who receives any kind of benefit gets £25 a week for any child they have under 16. You've got a family of three, that's £3,900 a year. Of course, you get child benefit for the third child as well, as you do in Northern Ireland, by the way, just not in Wales and in England. £3,900 a year means that no child in Scotland goes cold or hungry this winter. Tomorrow, Wales is debating this. England may not allow it to have the data to allow it to pay the children. Why does England want children to be cold and hungry? There's a nasty old phrase, which is that hunger is more effective than the overseer's whip to get people to behave. But what's even more effective than hunger is making people's children hungry. That will really get them doing any kind of job you want them to do. And that's where we are, post-Brexit, taking back control. Nasty. Nasty country, nasty party, nasty politics. Here's the last slide. So I'll leave that up. You can see where I stand. The benefits are not great. We have not particularly learnt from it. We don't have a sense of contrition. We don't think we've made a mistake. We are tolerating things that we would not have tolerated in 2018 and 2019. We are tolerating treating people in ways that we wouldn't have tolerated because we have shifted so far across. There are endless reasons to be hopeful, and it's also worth being hopeful, but I do think we have to say that Brexit as a programme didn't just fail on all the things it promised to achieve, it's also moved us into a new space on the edge of Europe, not just geographically, but the edge morally and how you're allowed to treat other people. Thank you very much.
So much, Danny. Yeah, do exactly as you're doing and pull your chair over here. Do you have those 10 reports that I gave you earlier?
Yes.
Okay, so the first thing we're going to do is deliver some reports to the overspill room because we are out. So we're going to take the ones that Danny was going to take back with him to Oxford, but we'll post some for you to use.
Yes, earlier.
To the overspill room. Yeah, she said she needs more. Okay, and we are, to those listening in the overspill room, I am sorry, but I'm glad that you were still able to see the event and didn't have to go home. So, Danny, thank you so much for that. We're going to respond with some questions and comments. I will start by just talking about Wales, because Zoe might have something she wants to say about Wales. It was a few years ago at... the LSE, my colleagues did a research project called the Local Brexit Research Project. And in some of their findings in that project, they discussed how there's this very interesting correlation that Welsh speakers were much less likely to vote for Brexit. And they muse in as a potential hypothesis, really, because it's not something you could prove exactly, that some people speculate that it might be because of tension with Westminster and criticism of Westminster played the role in Welsh politics that Brussels played in English politics. And I thought that was quite interesting in terms of your discussion of how this is introducing a kind of constitutional crisis in the UK. The second thing I was going to throw in is to come back to the first thing you said today about the European Union being a voluntary union, because I think this is so important to the way in which the Brexiteers misdiagnosed what the European Union was. They treated it and discussed it in terms of empire. I'm sure a number of people here has read Vinton O'Toole's work on this in really lambasting this absurd and often, really quite offensive idea that Britain was somehow a victim of an imperial project. Of course, that wasn't at all the case. And they got that misdiagnosis so wrong that it affected what came after the Brexit vote. So they imagined that once they exited the European Union, the sovereignty of England, or the United Kingdom, let's say England, as Danny is emphasising, would be turbocharged. And what they actually found was the very opposite was the case. That Britain was now in this very difficult, very tough, very challenging negotiation with a much larger trading bloc that had concretely led to a loss of sovereignty. And so what does that tell us about the European Union? Well, really, the European Union is not a sovereignty-denying bloc. You could argue that it's a sovereignty-turbo-charging bloc if you're lucky enough to be a member of it. And so this isn't you know, if you're Turkey or if you're a North African state, it's a little bit different. But if you're lucky enough to be a member of it, you find that the European Union offers the chance for small states to achieve things on the global level that they can't achieve in national isolation. It turbocharges their sovereignty. Look at the today. I work and research on Ukraine primarily, actually, desperate to join the European Union. It's not nice, actually, being on the outside of this bloc and locked in negotiations with it. So those are my two initial comments. We're now going to hear what Zoe has to say, and we'll also throw some questions to Danny as well. If you are watching on Zoom, please add your questions to the Q&A function. They are being read and sent to me. So Zoe.
Hello. I've got a question for both of you, which you'll probably say, well, if I've got a question for you and a question for you, I'm going to go with you first. So if you, we've had this conversation before about elite delinquency. There was this kind of, you know, amoral purpose behind the Brexit project. There was absolutely no compunction about lying, and there was no compunction about the damage it might cause, and there was no compunction about the impact it would have on already disadvantaged and struggling people. When you look at the political delinquency, it looks mechanical, right? The stupider the project gets, the stupider its adherents get, the stupider part of the composition of the party is, and you know, it's just a kind of, it's a mechanical failure. But when you look at the journalistic voice, and you talk about the Daily Mail and the anti-immigrant headlines, you know, you could add the Express and the Sun, of course, the Mirror hasn't covered itself in glory. It looks much more deliberate and strategic, and I wonder whether you think this is a mechanical failure of the elites or a strategic, considered, let's call it maybe a conspiracy of the elites.
Oh, I didn't introduce you, Zoe.
It's fine.
But she's very well known for being the co-host of Another Europe podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what she's like primarily known for. You also do a bit of writing, I think, but primarily known as the co-host of the Another Europe podcast. Danny.
The delinquency of the politicians. They weren't. George Osborne is not a particularly kind man, but he thought this was a bad idea. Johnson wanted to be Prime Minister, this was going to get him it. The bastards, which is what John Major called them throughout his career, I mean, they were going for a long time. And you do have to get into their heads about why this mattered to them so much. You don't want to get into Peter Bowes' head at the moment, but, you know, he was a leading Brexiteer, wasn't he? He's currently being, I think, suspended from the House today. The papers. If you know the journalists of the other papers, you'll know that they are just like you and I. They don't believe in this. It's a job. They have to write this stuff to keep their job. It's not them. At the Express, it's in the same office as the Mirror. I mean, it just, you move around. So it's about who owns the papers and what they say has to happen. And I think there's a couple of things going on. One is there's a fear amongst those who own the papers about things like non-dom status and their tax status and basically their family's money. Because if we were to stay in the EU might at some point say, you really can't have this set of people living in England, pretending they don't live in England, and not paying taxes. It's not Monaco. We introduced non-dom status at the time of the French Revolution to get the aristocrats to come here. So I think there's a personal thing about family, wealth, and position of newspaper proprietors. But secondly, there's the ideology that they and their families have, which is this ideology of superiority, of a country that is better than this, one where the rightful place is at the top of the planet, and if Britain isn't at the top of the planet, something must be going wrong, because their education from school and university and of their children is all about superiority. We were the place where Darwin announced that evolution and survival of the fittest happened. We were the centre of the largest empire the world's ever known. We produced the brilliant and amazing Daily Mail and the wonderful Telegraph. And those who own all the money, those brothers who also fell apart, they all fall apart. You keep going by thinking that you're really special. And you spend fortunes on your children's education because they will be special too. And one day, if you're Rupert, you're going to hand over to, what's his name, the one we don't know, Lockton. It's a weird... But I think it's...
Is that your answer? They're weird.
They're weirder than those that own and control the press in other countries. Where other countries, of course, are circular. Yeah. Other countries make sure, apart from Italy, which always annoys me on the graphs, Italy has a terrible press. Well, Italy's very unequal as well. You can control your press and what they're allowed to do. Really unequal countries like the USA and the UK allow a few people to dominate the press. Those who come to dominate it truly hold deep beliefs. And those who funded Brexit with money, which was, you know, Farage's headquarters were in a room below a hedge fund in Mayfair. He wasn't exactly hiding it. They have an ideology about greatness, of which they are at the vanguard through their great work making these millions through the hedge funds. But they would quite like the whole country to come up behind them and to be proud. And the reason why there are people, as far as they're concerned, on the streets and going hungry is that we're not working hard enough and we're not exploiting the rest of the world enough, because that's what we're really good at. So we need a giant gambling industry and the banking industry to be unfettered. Today it was reported that the bankers' bonuses are uncapped again, which really is go out, boys, and gamble, because their base salaries are going to go down tomorrow. And we have, of course, as I should say it and be careful, of course we have the best education in the world. Yeah? Come and pay. Right? It's a future. It's an income. It's a way of living. It is not secure. That's what worries me. Sterling is not secure. Our growing industries are not secure. They're not based on doing something useful for people. Right? And if we don't say it now, and if these industries grow, if our gambling industry doubles, if our banks get bigger, if our universities double the number of overseas students and then triple how much they pay, the Ponzi scheme eventually fails. And that's why I'm bothering to say this, because I'm 55 years old, and I really don't want to watch this happening in my old age and think, why didn't you say it? Right? There's no need. We can bail back from this. Right? The rest of the world doesn't think as lowly of our banks as I do. The gambling industry won't suffer if we knock it down 1% or 2% a year just by taxing it, which we don't do, thanks to Gordon Brown. Mate, I'm not going to have a go at Gordon, but it really annoys me when people say, oh, but Labour were different. It's just dangerous. The route we're going down is dangerous. Guernsey switched to banking, offshore banking and finance, when the market for the tomatoes in the glass houses in Guernsey fell apart because Spain worked out how to grow tomatoes. So Guernsey had to do something different. And it switched to dodgy offshore. We're now switching to something different like Guernsey. And we don't have to just do this. There isn't something about us that means we're so inept that we can't make things that other people need and do things that other people need. And we have to find a way of tricking them out of their money.
Okay, you've gone way off topic.
I am.
Way off topic.
It's not, though.
A question for you, because, you know, we spent a lot of time at Another Europe Is Possible trying to figure out how to turn what people plainly thought into some useful political action. That didn't go so well. But now there is buyer's remorse. There's buyer's remorse, there's remainer's remorse, there's leaver's remorse. You can't find anybody in the country who agrees with the decision. How do you make use of, or at the very least, give that some kind of concrete shape in the discourse?
It's unfortunate you asked me that, because earlier when Danny saw the Another Europe Is Possible leaflet that says, our time is now, he started laughing. But I think there is a That's in a way is the paradox, right? That at the moment where it's very, very difficult to do anything about Brexit,
yes,
practically,
yeah,
you do have all of these opinion polls showing stonking majorities to rejoin towards the end of the arduous Brexit process. And I mean, there's two statistics in the report that you have to kind of do a double take on. I couldn't believe the gambling statistics.
Yeah.
So when I saw that in the report, I did Google it myself. It's just completely it's completely astonishing that the UK has the largest gambling in absolute market in the world in absolute terms. What an indication of social failure. The other statistic that I'm related back to your question, Zoe, that I couldn't believe is that in that very difficult, very troubled Brexit debate between 2018 and 2019, there was a modest but real tendency for people to be happier.
Yeah.
And that then collapsed afterwards, which I think that you do capture something in your remarks earlier about that. There was sort of something exciting about that moment, that sense that there were lots of different possibilities at play, that there might be a new second referendum. In that period, I was spending a lot of time in mainland Europe, as we were calling it today, and it wasn't just a sort of British phenomenon. It was interesting that everywhere I went, the people asked me, what's going to happen with Brexit? Like, everyone was following the news. It was like this political experiment that was happening on the islands of the UK that everyone had a kind of stake in and interest in. So I think right now, I mean, in a way, what the job for campaigners and people who want to kind of keep alive a progressive pro-European vision is to a certain degree a waiting game, right? It's the old adage that, you know, you stick around until the politically impossible becomes the politically inevitable. Because at a certain point that inevitability, I'm sure, will become, in that sense, a possibility will be surface. But I think the job is really to keep promoting these ideas, to keep putting these arguments out there. What do you think, Danny?
I think, yeah, we can't shut up, and I may be wrong, I worry about this, about whether we ought to be kinder and more understanding, but I do think we have to say it has failed for the minority of people who cite various things that are wonderful, some trade agreement we've made with somewhere we never trade with, you know, that they are there are still people under the illusion that something good's happened. And I think we're at the point of making sure that the last few folk who think that we achieved something realise we didn't. And then those who say, give it enough time, need to know we've given it a lot of time, it's not looking good. We're borrowing at 5% on 30-year bonds. Well, that's 30 years ahead. That's, you know, you're going to have to wait 30 years for the achievement. And we still have to deal with Liz Truss not accepting that her 49 days were the most she was going to be given, and it wouldn't have worked if she'd been given 59 or 69. And we may have to deal with Braverman in a few weeks' time. So I don't think it's yet the time for reconciliation and kindness of understanding, but I did do 100 public talks after the referendum, all in the southeast of England, because most people voted Leave, voted it in the south. Despite the fact having a minority in the electorate, it was the South, not Sunderland. Mainly old, mainly in areas without a mainline rail station, voting Leave for their grandchildren and their children, overwhelmingly, again and again. People voted Leave, mostly the middle class, because they want a future for their children and their grandchildren. So there is a time to go back to that. But while there are still a few people telling us this is a wonderful thing we did, I do think a bit of ridicule, satire, and come off it is necessary, so that they hold those views inside their head and don't make them out loud words, as you say to children sometimes.
And we are going to move in a moment to questions, but there is a relevant question in the chat, which is exactly on a kind of riff of the question that Zoe asked, which is when will the rejoin moment come? I mean, when will the moment that in the next 5 years, 10 years? can you say something positive tonight, Danny?
No, but this is positive. So it won't be, if you're hoping for a referendum and suddenly we're back in, of course we have to go back in on normal terms, which will be good. But we'd have to join the Euro, we'd have to pay our fair share, not have the special deals, we'd have to sign up to everything, which will be good. But much more likely we go back in piecemeal, bit by bit, with the last thing that happens being members of the European Parliament. Because we have just taken out, since like 45 of the most far-right members of the European Parliament have exited. Like the centre of the far-right in Europe is now Poland. It was London. All these think tanks at Tufton Street are now stuck outside the EU. Like the Adam Smith Institute, their main headquarters in the EU is a little office in Warsaw. Like, as far as the EU is concerned, they've got rid of those really, really annoying people who were members of the far right of Europe. That was us. That's UKIP and the Conservative Party. Mm-hmm. So the last thing we're going to get back is MEPs. But either we're going to be this weird North Korea kind of separated place where you can't send a parcel. You try sending a box of chocolates to somebody in another country. Right, okay.
I don't know if that's quite the North Korean experience. It's not quite, it is just
bizarre. And either we're going, Taiwan, where you can send a box of chocolates from Taiwan to mainland China. Either we're going to be doing that for generations, you have to have a benefit to do that. You've got to have some geographical advantage, like Singapore, to be different. You can't sit there on the edge of the North Atlantic, not on some major shipping line that you happen to control because you've got the straits of whatever. We can't blockade Rotterdam. Right? We don't have a geographical advantage that means that staying out separately is... And our banks... Sterling is too small to make them trustworthy. So I think we go back bit by bit by bit. It's going to be painful. But at least if that's your expectation, then you can celebrate each jump back rather than just saying, why aren't we going back straight away? It takes time to do it. And we also need to work out how to give those old people who want better lives for their grandchildren and their children, better lives for their grandchildren and their children. We could do that tomorrow. And if you really want to make returning to the EU less of a problem, sort out the fact that people can't get a mortgage in their 40s, which is why their parents are voting Leave. Sort out the fact that 200 schools can't open the halls because the roofs could fall down. Right? Actually address the reasons that people voted Leave, which were to do with how bad the living standards of their younger relatives were getting. And then ask them, would you like to be back in again? When they no longer are in a European country with the highest rate of inequality, with the fastest falls that we've recorded in life expectancy, with only 5 countries in Europe having worse infant mortality than us, with the poorest fifth being poorer than the average for the poorest fifth of most of Eastern Europe. You can go on and on about we are peripheral, and asking a peripheral population that's labouring under the impression that it's at the top of the world or should be to do this, sort out your society a bit as well, which is cheap, as Scotland has shown. It doesn't take much money to stop children going hungry and cold. Right? And we need to do that, I think. And we need to think that matters. Yeah. And currently, we don't have a leader of a major party who think that matters enough.
Yeah. We should definitely go to the audience, right?
Yeah, do you want to say
something? I want to say, everybody ask a question, or not everybody.
there's a mic here. And so it
is. Yeah,
we're actually going to, if you're in the overspill room, mm-hmm. You, Medina, will you can raise your hand to ask your question, and you'll be passed over here. Medea will choose you.
Well, will she move them in here?
Yeah, to ask a question. They don't have a mic in there, apparently.
It's like Squid Game.
So, yeah, first question.
Thank you very much, Danny, for that rather dispiriting talk and a very negative impression that you've rightly, I think, put on the UK. My question to you is, though, what do we do about this? Because the major political parties, either Tory or Labour, don't seem to offer much hope. Our voting system doesn't allow us any choice, and it's unlikely to change because it benefits the two major parties. And everything goes through Parliament. So do you have any clues, any ideas about what we can do, where we can go?
Great question. So what's to be done on the democratic question? And then we do have some further, I want to just throw in one from the Zoom as well, in the interests of Zoom equality. So what will come first, United Ireland or independent Scotland, free to join the EU? So democratic crisis and the constitutional crisis in the UK. What do you think?
They're not easy. What do you do? Individual acts that actually go against what you're allowed to do. So when the First Minister of Scotland said he wanted to open up the hospitals of Scotland to people who needed it for emergency medical aid for what's happening in the Middle East, that's an act of defiance to London. Work on the Liberal Party because they may be in a position where you can't form a majority without them. They're likely to get a lot of seats given they come second in so many. The question is, do they have a backbone? Yeah. They didn't last time in 2010. They didn't demand PR as a reason to join. They could demand both PR and some form of the beginning of negotiations. We can't just walk back in. You know, we're now at the back of the queue. I do worry about the position of the Liberal Party, about how much they really want PR, how much do they really want to be in the EU. Because if we were, well, the chilling statistic I'll give you is if you look at the map of Liberal voters across Europe, there's hardly any of them. It's less than 1% in most countries vote for the group which has Liberals in it. Because the Liberal Party dies when you get PR. So work on the party and say, actually, do, you know, even if it might mean you die as a party, you know, the party for Conservatives who don't like confrontation, socially liberal, economically right-wing. But that's the practically to do, is to work on the Liberal Party and make sure that they've got the backbone to not agree to go into coalition with anybody who doesn't do these things. Don't know, 50-50 about Ireland, whether it'll be Ireland first or Scotland first. Freddie Heineken, the beer magnate, sponsored the Map of the Future of Europe. You can just Google Heineken Map of Europe. He paid two historians to do it, who are very good. It has all the large countries splitting up or becoming federal like Germany. When he first did it, people thought it was a bit of a joke, but then he got Yugoslavia exactly right. Well, they did, historians, which of course did split. So have a look at the Heineken map. The most interesting thing about the Heineken map is where they choose to be the capital of each of the new countries of England in the future. And it's very clever over how can you satisfy Northumbria and Yorkshire. Anyway. That's it. I'm an academic.
Great. I don't see a question from the overspill room, so let's go to here. Yeah.
Thank you so much for a very insightful discussion. My name is Rafael. I'm an LSE alum. I'm from Kazakhstan. I previously studied in the United States, and what I see is that there is a huge gap between the two countries. In the UK, there is a focus on redistribution, on equal share in a pie, like sort of. In the United States, the focus is on growing the pie. And I want to ask you, before you redistribute equally and before you reduce inequality and poverty, you need to grow the pie, because the bigger the pie, the bigger pieces you can read like or distribute. But in the UK, there is sort of like demonization of entrepreneurship. You don't see people idolizing and glorifying James Dyson, for example, or Richard Branson. Like, few people even know that they are British. But to grow the economy and to solve all the problems which you have indicated, you need engines of growth. So what will be the engines of growth if you have high taxation and other things? Because there will always be countries with a lower tax base. Thank you.
Ooh, great LSE question there. Redistribute or grow the pie. I was on holiday in the US in the summer, actually, and as you do when you're on holiday, you do a bit of research to see whether it correlates with one's experience of traveling around. And I think I often say this to an American students, the most striking thing for Europeans, and here I think, I'll see if Danny agrees, but we are England, the United Kingdom is still quite Western European in terms of inequality compared to the United States. So the most striking thing for Europeans is always how much poverty you see on the streets of the US. And when I looked at the data on this, I was really shocked to find that the median income in the US is not actually a very helpful category in the way that it is in Western Europe. Usually the mean and mode, when it comes to the income distribution, will overlap with one another. So in the US, it's very different from that, because the income distribution is basically flat, because you have enormous numbers of people in the bottom 20% and enormous numbers of people in the top 20%. So the median income in the United States is a stunning $85,000. It's a huge income, even in currency exchange terms. But it's not very representative of the mode, most Americans, right? Danny?
Okay. It's really important question. Politicians promise growing the pie. So in 2015, George Osborne said, if you follow my economic plan, we'll be the richest country in the world of any large size in GDP per capita. Johnson, in his resignation speech, said, keep following the plan and we'll get to the sunlit uplands. And he gave a different statistic for growth. Keir Starmer, twice in the last year, his main promise is economic growth. So almost exactly the same promise, about the highest growth amongst G7. The promise is slightly watered down each time, but our leading politicians say growth is the only way out of here. But we have a more socially liberal society. We have a memory of the 1960s, where our 1960s wasn't civil rights. Ours was the most amazing council house building, opening up our schools, so for the first time children could go to school with other children on their street and didn't have to take an exam at age 11. So our civil rights were rights between social classes, which I think is why you hear this about redistribution and sharing more. In Finland, the Free Finns, which is the most right-wing party in Finland in a left-wing state, the young men — it always scares me when young people are into the far right — the young men in Finland who support the Free Finns and wear a little lion lapel, Lion of Finland, say that they are the ones who make the cake, and people like me are ones who eat the cake, which I think, if you look at my stomach, you can see. So there is this rhetoric, even in Finland. The danger is that you end up with just talk about it has to be economic growth, as our economies, like the US, relatively falls and falls and falls from where it was, and as the UK shrinks in importance and size. And it's rhetoric. James Dyson moved his money to the Far East. Was it Branson, the other one you mentioned? Mm. Richard?
Yes.
Yeah. So he did a record label that was very good, but his space stuff isn't great. And we're cynical. If I was an American, I said this about — well, I would say it about Musk. You know, I don't think Musk is the greatest genius on the planet, but you have to ask, why is he so interested in getting off the planet? And one reason that Musk is so interested in getting off the planet is that the mantra of more economic growth requires another planet.
You can't do this growth endlessly without running out of resources and polluting too much. So you hit that problem. But we do need to do something useful. We can't simply reduce the size of our banking, our gambling industry, and make our education about education rather than about the business. And halve our standard of living again. Well, we have to do things that are useful. But the best guide to that is to look at what other countries do. What is it that the Finns do to bring in the money that allows them to carry on being Finland? And it isn't all sweetness and light and happy, you know, looking after the trees in the far north. It includes making cruise ships. Yeah, that's, and that includes inventing Wi-Fi, Nokia, protein that grows in labs so that you don't have to kill animals. There's lots of great innovations. The rate of innovation in Finland, in Norway, in Sweden per head is the highest in the world. The lowest rate of innovation and patents in the world, in the rich world, is the United States. The least actually entrepreneurial country in the rich world is the one who talks about it the most. But you can measure academic papers per head or in science or discoveries or simply the patenting of inventions. The one which throws it out, if you want to do this, I've done it in a little bit in a book called Do We Need Economic Inequality, is Switzerland. It's really, really annoying because Switzerland patents 10 times more things than anybody else because it has the pharmaceutical industry. But the USA is not innovative or entrepreneurial. In fact, it talks about it as these giant monopolies, you know, Microsoft and Amazon and so on. And we are remarkably un-entrepreneurial compared to mainland European countries, but they're entrepreneurs, the richest German families, you don't know who they are. There are far more billionaires in Germany than here, but they're quite modest about it, right? They don't go up in hot air balloons or complain as Dyson did loudly about how wonderful his vacuum cleaner was. And it is just a vacuum cleaner. So you're completely right, we need growth, but we should look at those countries that have the growth that works, that's sustainable, and ask about their modesty. How do they manage to do it without shouting about how brilliant Steve Jobs is, as if he single-handedly made that rather sleek computer that somebody like me now has to use for the rest of their life because, you know, the marketing people were clever, but the engineers were even cleverer.
Do we have a hard finish at 7:30, or
do
you want one
arbitration
question?
It is time, actually. I was thinking in my head that it was going to wait, but no, we do have a hard finish.
Are you sure?
If no one's keeping us out,
this gentleman did want another
wrong.
Question.
Yeah, we
can. Last question.
If we get kicked out in the middle of your question, we're going to have to take that.
Firstly, thank you very much. That's really, really good. I really enjoyed your presentation and everything you have both been saying. The gentleman over there was saying, what can we actually do to turn things around again? Have any of you ever heard of this book, The K Street Gang?
No.
So that basically talks about a scandal that happened 20 years ago in the States, and one of the people involved is a guy called Grover Norquist. And Grover Norquist was the guy that mentored and funded Matthew Elliott. And if you read this book, and I've got follow-up research, thousands of pages of it, it actually shows Russian money coming into K Street in Washington back through to the UK, and that's what caused it. And if people in Britain knew about this, they'd be horrified. So if you'd like to follow this up afterwards, I'd be more than happy to talk to all of you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I would be.
Okay, I'll just go. That's, yes, we shouldn't forget Matthew Elliott, in effect Dominic Cummings' boss, who, like those German entrepreneurs, has kept his name out. I wrote a book on this called Rule Britannia with Sally Tomlinson, and we wrote a letter to Matthew Elliott saying, we admire you so much, can we have a signed photograph we can put in our book? And he sent one. So there's a picture of Matthew Elliott in Rule Britannia, and it's on the web page for that as well.
Great. So I think we should. We started on. Well, we nearly started on time. And we should finish on time, thanks to the good grace of the institution. But thanks so much. Well, you just thanked yourself, because I was going to say thank you so much for coming. And that was a very hearty round of applause for yourself. But thank you so much, Danny, for joining us tonight. Thank you for everyone who's been watching online. It's been a terrific evening. And do take a copy of the report home with you. And if you didn't get one, it is available online at both the Another Europe If Possible website and the Friedrich Ehrlich Stiftung websites. Thanks. Have a good evening.
Weird.